Last time we talked about making key concepts automatic. This is all in the service of on your test, the more that you can automatically know what every sentence means, the better you will do. I can virtually guarantee that. You read a sentence and you just know what it means, your test is going to go much more smoothly. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say. The hard thing is to figure out how do we do that. Last time we talked about making key concepts automatic. This idea that you want to be able to see someone that's hypotensive and tachycardic and immediately be thinking about the baroreceptor reflex. That's the first step. The second step, though, is to actually be able to put it together in an actual vignette and to drill these vignettes. What I've done here is I've created vignettes where we're going to A, drill those automatic key concepts that they just become something that you reflexively see when you're doing questions. But B, I'm going to give you cards and that you can then turn into vignettes that you can drill these concepts and continue to reinforce the connections. We're going to start with Hadra. The way that this is going to work, actually, all of you guys are going to read this vignette, and I'm going to call in Hadra because I want her to tell me what the pathophysiologic chronology is. But for all of these, I want you all to do it, and I will choose one of you to go over the pathophysiologic chronology. Everyone read this. You don't have to read it out loud, but I want you to tell me what's the pathophysiologic chronology. Walk through the pathophysiologic chronology, and I want you to specifically tell me what's the mechanism for developing type 2 diabetes. And why is he orthostatic?
The mechanism for type 2 diabetes is mellitus, is that there is insulin resistance, and that insulin resistance results in increased in insulin production and increased myelin production. And that myelin production, whenever there is increased production of proteins in our body, there is always going to be increased production of misfolded proteins in our body. And some of those misfolded proteins can be ubiquitinated, and others are not degraded by ubiquitination. And those proteins aggregate, and one of those proteins aggregating and through hydrophobic interactions is amyloid. When we have type 2 diabetes mellitus, we have a lot of insulin production because the cells are essentially resistant to proteins, and we have a lot of production of misfolded proteins, and we have a lot of production of amyloid, and that amyloid aggregates because of hydrophobic interaction into beta-pleated sheets, and then that actually deposits in the pancreas, and that results in dysfunction of the pancreas. Over time, the pancreatic beta cells become dysfunctional, and there is even more decreased production of insulin, which really results in a relative insulin deficiency.
That was really good. I am really impressed. I don't even think I need to teach that, what I was planning on teaching. That was really good. Great. So why is he orthostatic? Walk me through the pathophysiologic chronology. How do you connect all this now?
It's just that obviously diabetes mellitus equals hyperglycemia. The blood has a lot of blood glucose inside it, and because of that blood glucose, there is non-enzymatic glycosylation of the arteries. And because of that, I think there is basically less blood flow. The normal response of when a person gets up is that initially, when a person gets up, there is pooling of blood in their veins, and because of that, there is a decreased preload in the heart, because of which there is decreased stroke volume. When the stroke volume decreases, there is decreased cardiac output, and when the cardiac output decreases, there's decreased MAP. When the MAP decreases, there is a decreased stretch on the baroreceptor reflex, and there's a decreased stretch on the baroreceptor.
Okay, so that's good. You're walking through the normal healthy mechanism. What I'm
Yeah,
asking is why
that's
is it?
normal, but in diabetes mellitus, there is basically the nerves are basically weak because the blood can go to the nerves and it's not providing the nutrients. The nerves are not functioning at their best. When we get lightheadedness and we have an alpha activation and we have vasoconstriction, that is basically being prevented, and the blood is not able to go to the person's brain, and that's why they're lightheaded.
Okay, how did that feel?
Yeah, that felt okay.
Yeah, that's not bad. It felt a little meandering at the end. In a test, it would be a little hard because I feel like the risk that you run with going into so much detail on the normal mechanism is that it's going to take too much time. Granted, this is a artificial scenario, but in an actual test, that would probably be a little like going over the normal baroreceptor reflex is probably too much. But otherwise, that was actually quite good. What I'm going to show you is this is the level at which, in an actual timed test, this is probably the level at which I would think about it. You don't have to go into details about how do you get diabetes. I asked you to go through the details of why you get diabetes. Someone was asking, what do you do in an actual test? What should you actually do in a test scenario? You can't go through, thinking about amylin, every time diabetes, you can't be thinking of amylin production because of insulin resistance. That's just too much. You just say diabetes. In a test setting, this is about the level at which I would think about it. There's some sort of diabetic neuropathy of the autonomic nervous system. You get baroreceptor reflex dysfunction, and that's why you're getting hypotensive and orthostatic. That's it. However, when you're not doing this in a test, in a non-test scenario, I would want you to go through as much detail as possible. And the reason is because the more detail you can give, the more that this will become natural in your test, and the more that you'll be able to review it. Let's talk about some of this. This is the mechanism of type 2 diabetes, which Hadra just explained. There's insulin resistance that leads to overproduction of insulin. That insulin overproduction also, amylin is released along with insulin, which leads ultimately to amyloid production. The amyloid leads to beta islet cell dysfunction, and now you have a decrease in insulin supply to go along with increase in demand. And that is diabetes. Technically, it just means diabetes mellitus technically just means you have high blood sugar. This I took directly from the lecture endocrinology, the diabetes mellitus and thyroid lecture. Briefly, to walk through the mechanism of getting amyloid, you have a protein, some proteins, there's a non-degradable part, and if there's misfolding, you'll get ubiquitination of it. And for step one, they love ubiquitin, love the proteasome. It seems to always be the answer when that's one of the answer choices. You can degrade the degradable part, but the non-degradable part, the hydrophobic part, you can't degrade. When you're making more and more proteins, in the case of having insulin resistance and having increase in insulin, you will then accumulate these non-degradable parts. But the non-degradable parts will accumulate, and eventually what happens is that they polymerize. They now join together to form the superstructure of the beta-plated sheet, which we call amyloid. Great. What's the significance of the fact that he had 20 years of diabetes and that it's poorly controlled? Why did I say that in the vignette? And why do they say that in other vignettes? Pooja, what do you think?
You wanted to draw attention to the fact that poorly controlled diabetes can lead to the renal... Does the guy have renal failure? I forget.
He had renal failure. Yeah, why did I say he had renal failure? Why was that important? Why would you have to include that? Or why would I include that in the vignette? Play directly into the orthostasis, right? It didn't necessarily play directly into the vignette, but it was still important. But it's because the point is that a lot of these late manifestations happen similarly, concomitantly, right? Kidney disease oftentimes happens with like retinopathy. But if you're going to get peripheral neuropathy, it's also reasonable to think that you are at risk of having autonomic neuropathy. I was building towards this idea that he had autonomic neuropathy. Tingling in hands and feet may seem like a distractor, but really what it's telling you is just the overall state of his disease. If someone says, this is someone who's got insulin-dependent diabetes, insulin-dependent type 2 diabetes, it just means it's really bad diabetes. Someone comes in with diabetes and they've got kidney failure. It just means that they have really bad diabetes and they are at risk of having these other complications. Great. We talked about this last time, but I don't want to spend too much time talking about this, but the normal baroreceptor reflex was what Hadja was going through. If I was going to make a tattoo, it would say MAP is cardiac output times TPR equals heart rate times stroke volume times TPR, and then preload, afterload, and contractility. Sometimes you can think about rhythm, and this is the mechanism. But hopefully you guys have, every single time that you've been standing up, you have been thinking about the baroreceptor reflex, that you can make this an automatic key concept. Because I guarantee, if you're not drilling this into your head now, on the day of your test, it's not going to come to mind naturally. You're going to be time pressured. You're going to be stressed. This is the last thing you're going to be thinking of. The time to practice this is when you're not in a timed setting. When you're exercising, when you get up, when you stand up from a seated position, when you get up from bed, whatever it is, right? But you want to make this, you want to learn how to make this automatic. Because the more that you can make knowing the right answer or knowing what every sentence means automatic on your test, the happier you will be with your score. I can guarantee that. We talked about heart rate last time. I don't want to spend too much time talking about this, but the reason that M1 causes an increase in heart rate is because of the phase 4 depolarization. Danielle, what's the equations for cerebral perfusion?
Cerebral perfusion pressure equals mean arterial pressure minus intracranial pressure.
Great. And how generally can you think about when I say perfusion pressure? What's a good way of thinking about that?
Resistance? Is that what, like in the...
Oh, no, like in general. If I think of blank perfusion pressure, what's the generic equation for perfusion pressure? That's a bad question. Basically, what's the pressure of the system that you're coming from? Right. In this case, it's the arterial system.
Oh, okay.
Minus the pressure of the system you're going to, right? In this case, speeds of brain inside. In general, because a lot of people have just memorized this. I'm saying you don't have to memorize this. You can actually make sense of it. The perfusion pressure on your brain is what's the pressure of the blood going to your brain minus the pressure inside your brain. Pretty much it. The other famous perfusion pressure equation, which we'll talk about eventually, is coronary perfusion pressure, which is usually written as aortic diastolic blood pressure minus left ventricular end diastolic pressure. Because your coronaries fill during diastole, usually, at least the left-sided ones, and they're going to the heart, where ultimately, right, the blood is going to end up in the left ventricle. So you're looking at the diastolic blood pressure, but it's coming from the aorta. It's ending up in the heart. The perfusion pressure is just pressure it's coming from minus pressure it's going to. Hadra, tell me, why is he lightheaded? Using the cerebral perfusion pressure equation, why does he get lightheaded when he stands up?
Well, he gets lightheaded because the MAP decreases and the intracranial pressure is high. Basically, the cerebral perfusion pressure decreases.
Yeah, I don't even know that I would say that ICP is high. The ICP is probably normal.
Okay.
But the point is that the ICP is unchanged. If this decreases relative to this, then yeah, your cerebral perfusion pressure is going to go down. Yeah. Cool? Yeah. Great. When someone presents with lightheadedness or syncope when they're standing, what's the general mechanism behind lightheadedness? And could this be a stroke? Pooja, can you tell us, what's the general mechanism behind lightheadedness and or syncope?
Oh boy.
Remember you were saying before, you were like, yeah, you know, someone comes in, they're unconscious. Yeah, I don't know what that means. What, you're supposed to know what that means? Yeah. Yeah, this is pretty much. Yeah, the general unconsciousness is a little different from syncope, which I'll explain. But yeah, it should be automatic. I've bolded all the questions that I want you guys to make into cards. We'll give you the cards.
The whole chronology, though.
Well, so yeah, there's going to be two kinds of cards. There's going to be the ones that I bolded. This is an automatic key concept. This is a concept that I want you to make automatic. When you see someone that's lightheaded, you want to think hypotension. In a general, in a very general sense, if someone's intermittently lightheaded or if they're syncopal, maybe not 100% of the time, but I'd say 90 to 95% of the time, particularly in questions, particularly for syncope, if it's truly pre-syncope or syncope, virtually 100% of the time it's going to be. I know there's going to be haters out there who are going to say, actually, technically, you can be syncopal from... Yes, technically it's true. But that's really uncommon. That's hot air balloonists. Yeah, but... In general, you should think hypotension when someone's lightheaded. I bolded this because I want you to make this an automatic key concept. In other words, I want you to be thinking about this when you see syncope. Oh, I know they're hypotensive. It should just come to your mind. That's what I want. Pooja, does that make sense?
Yes.
Perfect. I'm just spelling it out for you. This is what I wish that people told me. Pooja, can you tell me, could this be a stroke?
If
someone presents with lightheadedness, what's the likelihood that this is a stroke if they're lightheaded?
I think it could be.
No. Almost never a stroke. That, I would argue, is probably a cognitive error. And I think if I had to reconstruct it, I think that the way that it happens is that people think of lightheadedness as a brain thing. Then your system one just goes, you know, oh, headedness, brain pathology. Oh, what's a brain pathology? Oh, yeah, stroke. Stroke's a brain pathology.
Here's a case where sometimes you do get a patient that comes in and says, the scenario will say, you know, the patient comes in with the lightheadedness and the syncope, blah, blah. But then the vignette's talking about the symptoms of a stroke.
I've yet to see a vignette like that. Please bring that next time.
I'm not saying that I've seen it. What, again, I struggle with is when I see something like this and I associate it with the hypertension, am I going to lock myself in? That's what I kind of get scared of.
Oh, great. Yeah, exactly. This is why you have a system too, right? I'm not saying that if you say hypertension for syncope, you're going to be right 100% of the time. There's maybe a couple percent or 5% of the time where it's not going to be that. In other words, what was the trick of using your system too? What did we call that last time? Trust but verify. In other words, say, oh yeah, totally. I think that they are most likely hypotensive. But then verify. Do they have other symptoms of hypotension? When you look at the blood pressure, is it low? You still have to check it. I'm not saying that your test is just going to be like you're not thinking at all and everything is going to be automatic. No, absolutely not.
Okay, yeah, so I'm approaching questions with system one and I am doubting my questions with system one as well. Like system two is like non-existent for me.
Exactly. What I'm trying to do with this is I want to strengthen your system one. I want to strengthen your system one so your system one is giving you the right answer more frequently. However, we also need to strengthen your system too, that it can take that answer and actually evaluate it and say, oh, does this make sense or not? But I think the problem is that a lot of you guys, your thinking is more this. Oh, lightheaded. Oh, yeah, lightheaded. Oh, it's brain. Oh, brain problem. What's a brain problem? Oh, yeah, I think of stroke. No, that will lead you down the wrong path. virtually 100% of the time. I've bolded this because I want to make this an automatic concept. When you see syncope or presyncope, you should be thinking hypotension, because in virtually 100% of, I'd say 95% of the time, just to be fair, you should be thinking this will guide you in the right way. Mike said in her text to me, she said, I think it's good to think of stroke as focal neurological deficit, which is totally true. Trust but verify. What's the classic presentation of stroke? Well, the classic presentation of stroke is a focal sudden neurologic deficit. You suddenly have trouble speaking, or you can't move your leg or something. That's the classic presentation. Great. Next, let us, Danielle, I want you to walk us through maybe just the overall big picture in terms of the pathophysiologic chronology.
Basically, this elderly man was born healthy. Probably some poor life choices, probably poor diet, maybe decreased exercise, led him to develop diabetes type 2, led him to have insulin resistance, an increase in insulin resistance, which caused an increased production of insulin to compensate for the resistance. And then this caused an increase in amylin. Do you want me to go through everything?
But I think that's a big picture. That's actually, yeah, this is a delicate thing. I guess I would say when you're doing it on your own, I would want you to go through everything. For the interest of time, to make sure that we can cover enough vignettes, say abbreviate a little bit.
Since we already discussed the whole process of how type 2 diabetes occurs, I'll just go over that, skip that. Basically, his long-standing type 2 diabetes led him to have these kind of end-stage factors such as renal failure and the autonomic dysfunction. And the autonomic dysfunction caused him to have baroreceptor reflex dysfunction, so he's not able to the job when he stands up.
You're cutting out. I think what you're saying is that he can't augment his cardiac output, which means his MAP doesn't increase. And because his MAP doesn't increase, his cerebral perfusion pressure falls. I think that's what you're getting at. What I've included here are the bolded questions, are the key concepts you want to make automatic. You see someone that's presyncopal, you should think hypotension. You should not think stroke. Presyncope or syncope, virtually, I don't know, 100% of the cases, at least for vignettes, and even in the real world, is almost always because of hypotension. Vasovagal syncope, hypotension. Cardiac syncope, any of the causes. Aortic stenosis, hypotension. Non-sustained VTAC, hypotension. All of them, they're all hypotension. In the test, this is about the level of detail. In a question, that would be one card, or the bolded things, we will include that. The other kinds of cards that I'm going to include is this one. The front of the card would be this vignette, and the back of the card would be this. And when you're reviewing it, should you do the summary or should you do the detailed one? Which do you think is better? Duralis, what do you think? If I'm reviewing this and I'm not in a time setting, which do you think I should go through?
Detailed.
Absolutely, yeah. And a fair question is, Alec, isn't this just a god-awful waste of time? Why would I do that? Why would I, seriously?
Muscle memory for your brain.
Yeah, exactly. Because all of this stuff, I guarantee, certainly for step one, but even for most of this for step two, are things that are gonna be on your test. Yeah, it's gonna take you a little bit longer, for sure. But then look at all the things that you're reviewing. It's crazy, there's all this stuff. And the other benefit is that, yeah, you're essentially creating muscle memory that the next time you see someone who has some form of autonomic dysfunction and they've got diabetes and kidney failure, and you're like, oh, I totally makes sense. Because maybe next time it's not going to be that they have, maybe it's not that they're going to have autonomic problems of your sympathetic system in terms of blood pressure, but maybe it's that they're going to have diarrhea. There's just no clear reason why. And you're like, oh, they've got tingling hands and feet and kidney failure. It stands to reason that they might have autonomic dysfunction as well. Maybe they've just got a problem with their sympathetic system into their GI tract. Their parasympathetic system's overactive and they're getting diarrhea because of that. You want to train yourself to be able to make these connections on the spot. And if you wait until your test, until you try to make them, you'll never make them. It's not going to happen. Because it just becomes that much harder on the day of your test to do this in a timed setting when you're stressed. Just not going to happen. That was great. I'm going to ask all of you guys to read this quietly to yourself. And then I'm going to have Duralis walk us through what the pathophysiologic chronology of this one is. This one's pretty tough. Duralis.
Born healthy male. I guess he's probably had some unhealthy lifestyle changes or habits, sorry, that with the smoking. And now at an elderly age is... Actually, I don't know where to go to here. I know what he
has. It's hard. This one's hard.
But I don't know how to get to there from this.
Yeah, I know. Okay, does someone else want to give it a shot? This is one of the harder ones. But again, this is totally fair game for your test. Maite, do you want to give it a shot?
A 67-year-old man comes to the emergency department because of working leg pain. That can be a lot of things, but he has lightheadedness. 1 month history of upper mid-thoracic back pain. I think of something in the aortic, maybe aortic very section.
Okay, so stop. Let me point something out to you guys. Your system one is unaware of time. Let me repeat this. In other words, your system one doesn't really know what happened first, what happened second, what happened third. It's just completely oblivious to time. You have to, if you're going to think about the actual chronology, you actually have to arrange the vignette in chronological order. Mm-hmm. I want you to actually arrange this in chronological order. What happened first and then what happened second, just in terms of the elements of the vignette. You don't have to tell me why it happened, but just which sense.
This was a healthy man, and then he started smoking, mm-hmm. which is a risk factor for to develop 20 years ago. That's a long time, and that increases your risk of a lot of things, but he has a CT that demonstrates that he has a mass on the pancreas. Maybe he starts smoking, this increases risk to develop pancreatic cancer, and pancreatic cancer develops his, how do I say this, hypercoagulability. Also, he still smokes. It's a 67-year-old man who starts smoking, develops pancreatic cancer, made him to develop thrombosis. He has a DVT, and then he developed PE, and the PE worsening pain is because of the DVT, and then the DVT progressed to a PE, pulmonary embolism, that gave him the lightheadedness.
Perfect. That was fantastic. That was great. Do you see how different it is, though? For those of you that maybe weren't able to make all those connections, my guess is as you were going, it was hard to tell because you were going down the wrong path. I don't think I was being very clear in what I wanted. But the key is that you, oftentimes what you'll see, this is exactly how they're going to give it to you in the vignette. Because this is the chief complaint. He comes in, they might not even give it to you like this. They might even say, a 67-year-old guy comes in with a 2-day history of lightheadedness. And that's it, because that's the chief complaint. And then they might tell you for a week he's had worsening left leg pain. And then they'll say he's had a month of worsening upper thoracic pain. Because this is HPI business now. And then they're going to tell you about their smoking history, this 20-pack year history, way down at the bottom, because that's where their social history goes. Mm-hmm. What I see a lot of you guys do with your pathophysiologic chronologies is they're not actual chronologies. You're just going sentence by sentence, which is essentially what you were doing, I think. Right? That's not what
I want. So I want to ask you a question while I practice, while I do my test.
When you do your test, like, do this. You should also arrange them chronologically in your mind. Because it's harder. Yeah. Because if you don't arrange it in your mind, your system one's not going to do it. Right? You're not naturally going to do this. No matter how many times you do questions, you're not naturally going to make those connections. I would argue that when I present it like this, my guess, a lot of you guys were like, oh my God, I have zero idea what's going on. But if I were to present it like this in the actual chronology in which it happened, I didn't even tell you that he had pancreatic cancer. I didn't tell you any of the background of any of these things. Right? I just now have just arranged them in order of the actual timing of them. It became much more clear what was going on when you arrange it in that order.
Yeah, I think as I finish, because when I read the vignette, I start taking things out, and as I finish before doing the analog, but I do it really quick. That's maybe why I think I might not do it, but yeah, because it's a second reflex. I don't know how to explain it.
Pooja, what are your thoughts? If you saw it this way versus if you saw it this way, which is easier for you, Pooja? What do you think?
I think the bottom, it's a little bit more clear why one 20 pack year smoking history is the reason that he's got the pancreatic mass, is the reason he's got the weight loss, is the reason he's got the upper back pain. I would think that this would be the easier one.
Totally. Yeah. Are you naturally going to do this though?
I'm trying.
Yeah. I guess my point is that your system one will not do this.
Right.
Just reading a vignette, this will not become immediately obvious to you. Instead, when I read a vignette, whenever I see like days, weeks, I actually take an extra second and I actually think this happened first. I would read this and I would say, okay, so he's got leg pain and then lightheadedness. Oh, actually before that, he's got back pain, then leg pain, then lightheadedness. And I'm like, oh, actually no, it's smoking, then pain, or sorry, smoking, back pain and mass, leg pain and lightheadedness. I actually think, and as I'm going, I'm trying to put those pieces together.
Well, if you think about that, then they should put the social history as the first thing in the vignette so you don't have
it. Not necessarily, because the social history isn't always one of the key things. The reason why the H&P is laid out the way that it is because then you know what to expect, what to listen to in every step. You could argue maybe that you could put it in the HPI, but they will not always do that for you. They will not, both clinically and on your test. But I want you guys to see that it's much easier to see the connections if you actually arrange it in chronological order, which is why I keep telling you guys, you have to make actual chronologies. It's not sentence by sentence in terms of, that's not what a pathophysiologic chronology is. You have to read it sentence by sentence. But what you're trying to build in your head is this happened first, this happened second, this happened third, this happened fourth. And I would argue that this is the exact same process that you should be doing clinically. Because if you just think about it in the order that the patient tells it to you, it is much, much harder for you to make sense of it than if you're saying, take me back from the beginning. When is the first time that you were well? And actually think, okay, try and make it in chronological order. So this would be the summary. As you're going through the test, this is about the detail that I would want you to go through it in a time setting. Smoking leads to cancer, pancreatic cancer, a lot of things. But in this case, it was the major risk factor for getting pancreatic cancer. And then smoking and pancreatic cancer are two, right? So what you guys didn't talk about was the fact that it's not just pancreatic cancer. He was smoking too. That's two out of three of Virchow's triad. That leads to DVT. Well, that leads to cerebral hyperperfusion. Virchow's triad. What are the three elements in Virchow's triad? Hypercoagulability, venous stasis, and endothelial damage. Danielle, what does Virchow's triad predispose you to, and how many are necessary in order to be predisposed?
Yeah, so it'll predispose you to getting thromboembolisms and PEs and things like that, and you need two of the factors.
Yeah, it's basically venous clots. Venous clots, CBT. Yeah, I typically need two out of the three. Great. And Danielle, which elements of Virchow's triad does this patient have?
Yeah, so our patient has the pancreatic cancer causing the hypercoagulability and then the long history of smoking, which is going to cause the endothelial damage.
Perfect. Smoking is endothelial damage. Pancreatic cancer is hypercoagulability. Great. Duralis, what is it? Generally, what does it mean when they say that there's a provoked or an unprovoked DVT? What is that referring to?
I'm not sure, but I'm assuming it has to do with if you're causing it due to something that you're doing, lifestyle changes, problems, or versus no.
Yeah, provoked basically means that there's a very clear precipitant, very obvious. Unprovoked is where it's not immediately clear what is like causing it. And Hadra, which would be more concerning, the provoked or the unprovoked, and why?
I think the unprovoked is more concerning because in provoked, you have a clear precipitant that you can take care of. For example, in our case, smoking, we could tell the patient to stop, quit smoking. For unprovoked, I think we're more concerned as to now we have to dig in about the reason.
Like, what would you be concerned about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually unprovoked are much more concerning. Oftentimes the thing that you worry about is genetics or some sort of undiscovered factor. And this guy, they didn't necessarily know that he had cancer. Presumably he didn't know he had cancer when he presented to the emergency department. It's a double whammy. It's, oh, by the way, you have DVT-PE. Oh, and by the way, you have pancreatic cancer. But the pancreatic cancer was that unclear precipitant. It was the one that you didn't know about. But that's what you really worry about. It actually happened to one of the professors at Stanford. He just developed a DVT. And it turns out, right, it was an unprovoked DVT because he was playing tennis. And it turns out that he has factor V Leiden. Wow. This stuff is real. That's crazy. But yeah, that was unprovoked. Great. Now I want to talk about resistors. Let's talk about resistors in series versus in parallel. Luis, you can think about blood vessels, resistors, and series or parallel. This is series. It's where one resistor is after another. I have no choice. I've got to go. If I want to go from this point to this point, I've got to go through all the resistors. If it's parallel, I've got a choice, basically. Technically, I'm not choosing, but there are multiple paths through the different resistors that I can take. These are resistors in parallel. Louise, can you tell us what's the total resistance equal to if there are resistors that are in series?
Would it be the sum of the four resistances?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Total resistance is just, you just add them up. It's the easiest one. If I remove a resistor in series, what's the effect, Louise, on the total resistance? Is it going to increase it or decrease it?
It will decrease it.
Yeah, great. Right? Because it's just a story. Take this out, it's going to decrease it. Great. Pooja, for resistors in parallel, what's the total resistance?
1 over R1, 1 plus 2.
Equals what?
Equals, I don't know.
Does it equal the total resistance? Yeah. What is it equal to? Yeah, everyone remembers this side of the equation. No one remembers this side of the equation. It's actually 1 over R total. And I've made this mistake multiple times. I used to think that it was R total equals 1 over R1 equals, right? That's why I asked you. Because I've definitely made that mistake before. But no, it's actually 1 over R total equals 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2 plus 1 over R3. Because that's important because, Pooja, what is the effect of removing a resistor in parallel? What effect? Does it increase the total resistance or does it decrease the total resistance?
In parallel, I think it increases.
Yeah, it increases it. Great. Let's prove it. Let's prove it to ourselves. So let's just make the math easy. We've got three resistors. They all have the same resistance, and that resistance is 2. I'm not even going to use units, just to make it really easy. 1 over R total, this is for parallel, this is in parallel. It's going to be 1/2 plus 1/2 plus 1/2. If we rearrange the terms, we'll find that R total, right, is 2/3. Do we agree? Now, let's say that we remove one of the resistors. Now, we've taken out R3, let's say. Now, it's just 2 resistors. 1 over R total equals 1/2 plus 1/2. But what do you know? The total resistance is now, it's one of those weird things, because I haven't really thought about reciprocals for a really long time. But do the math, prove to yourself that removing resistor in parallel will increase the total resistance. Great. In other words, if I have a PE, what's it going to do to my pulmonary resistance? Danielle, would I consider my left and right pulmonary arteries to be resistors in series or in parallel?
Resistors in parallel.
Great. And if I had a pulmonary embolism to my right pulmonary artery, Danielle, what would be the effect on my total pulmonary arterial resistance if I were to think of them as resistors? This is a key concept. I've bolded it.
Yeah. If we're thinking about our pulmonary arteries in parallel, then if you were to remove or block our right pulmonary artery, then you'd be removing one of those resistors in parallel, then your total resistance would increase.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly. Excellent. Excellent. It's duralis. How could a PE lead to hypotension? Another key concept.
Since the PE that it's in parallel and you're taking away one of the resistance on one side, it's causing an increase in total resistance though, then that increase in total resistance is going to lead to a decrease in forward flow. That's going to cause you to have less blood pumping forward, including to your left side of your heart, meaning less stroke volume, less cardiac output.
Skipping a step, why is there less volume? Think of your tattoo. If you're going to make a tattoo.
Okay. So anything that's in front, or I guess after the pulmonary embolism, is going to have a decrease in preload. If you have an increase in preload, it's going to cause an increase in volume to your left. Decrease in volume to your left atrium, which causes a decrease in volume to your left ventricle, and that's how you get the decrease in stroke volume.
Sorry, this might be a technicality, but really, I guess the way that I would think about it, and I think the way that they to test this would be, I would say there's a decrease in volume to the left atrium, decrease in volume to the left ventricle, that's great. I would say that means that there's a decrease in preload. Because I think what you were saying, maybe I misunderstood, was that a decrease in preload leads to a decrease in volume. That's not usually how it's described physiologically. Usually you think of it from the context of the left ventricle itself. There's a decrease in left ventricular volume, which means that there's a decrease.
Okay, that's true. Left ventricular end-diastolic volume.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what you think of as preload. Not that preload leads to a decrease in your left ventricular end-diastolic. But yeah, decrease in stroke volume.
Decrease in stroke volume leads to a decrease in cardiac output, which leads to a decrease in your MAP.
Great.
Decrease in your mean arterial pressure means less blood in your arterial system, which means less blood to your brain.
Remember, the key is that you want to use these concepts that we just talked about. If you don't use them now, you're not going to use them on your test. It's not going to be automatic on your test.
I don't know what's the term for that. Maybe I wasn't here.
Perfusion pressure. Oh, you might not have been here. Yeah. Cerebral perfusion pressure.
Oh, so is that the cerebral perfusion pressure equals
MAP minus ICP?
Because your MAP is decreased.
Yeah, your cerebral perfusion pressure is decreased. Yeah, exactly. Okay. In other words, yeah, larger PEs are more likely to give you hemodynamic effects to drop your MAP. And it's that decrease in MAP, which is ultimately decreasing your cerebral perfusion pressure. And that's where you're lightheaded. Great. Now, I want you to read this exact same vignette. Now that you've learned those key concepts, now that we've drilled those key concepts, right? Now I want you to read the vignette and I want you to tell me, because my hope is that now you're able to make the connections automatically much more. In order to further that, I want you to make this into a card and actually think, why did he get a DVT? Why is he lightheaded? Why is he tachycardic? Hadra, can you tell us? Can you give us the high level? Don't go into really excruciating detail, but just the high level summary. And then we can save the excruciating detail for when you guys go over this on your own.
Yeah, the pathophysiology chronology will be such that this 67-year-old has been smoking for the last 20 years, and that's a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. And both of those are risk factors. They kind of make the Virchow's triad. There is endothelial damage, and there is hypercoagulability, which results in DVT. And the DVT from there dislodges an embolus, which causes PE. And that PE actually increases resistance to blood flow, and there is decreased cardiac output, which decreases the MAP and which decreases the cerebral perfusion pressure. And when the cerebral perfusion pressure decreases, and the decrease in MAP also results in activation of the sympathetic outflow because of the baroreceptor reflex.
Perfect. Honestly, that's okay. Like that level of detail, because again, I want to train you in two ways. I want to show you when you're going through this in a timed setting, you have to know which details to cut and which to not, right? What are the big picture elements that you need to still have a complete story, reasonably complete story, versus what are you going to do when it's on your own and you want to go over these details, because these are details that could certainly be tested in other For in a test, this is it. I'd say smoking, pancreatic cancer, at least a DVT, TPE, LUMAP, supraconfusion, done. In a test, this is about as much detail as I would give. But outside of a test, this is the level of detail that I would try to do. I would even get down to the point of saying, yeah, you get a PE. The PE leads to you're removing a resistor in parallel, because that's a really important concept, thinking of resistors in parallel versus in series. And then, yeah, go through all of it. Cool? I think we might even have time for one more. Luis, I'm going to have all of you guys read this, but I'm going to have Luis go over the pathophysiologic chronology. Luis, would you like to give us the pathophysiologic chronology?
A 36-year-old woman who was born healthy. They don't specify for how long she has been smoking or using the oral contraceptives, but let's say that she was born healthy. When she gets to a reproductive age and starts having sexual activity, she starts taking the oral contraceptives, and she probably starts smoking as well. She probably develops a DVT, or
she smokes in TPs. Then she takes a flight.
That sentence in the chronologic sequence. She was a 36-year-old woman. She was born healthy. She smokes, uses OCP, and then she takes a long flight from South Korea to LA. From sitting down for quite a long time, she develops DVTs. During the flight, she gets to LA and all of a sudden she starts complaining. She probably develops DVTs and then those clots.
I'm going to stop you there. That was not bad. What I want to point out is that this is probably how a lot of vignettes feel to a lot of you guys. You're reading it and honestly, you probably don't even give it as much effort as Luis just gave. You probably just like, oh, I don't know. Target venous extension. Oh, lungs clear. I don't know. And you choose an answer. That's usually about the level that I think most people understand most vignettes. And there are two choices that you have when you see a vignette like this. The first is to just say, oh, look at the answer, read the educational objective and say, oh yeah, I get it. Oh yeah, whatever. I'll get it next time. The second thing, which is what I want you guys to do, is to actually go through and make sense of the pathophysiologic chronology. I actually walk you through step by step when you have the answer in front of you. Because what you'll find, and the reason why I'm showing you, I'm very intentionally showing you the vignette in the beginning and at the end of each of these, is because I want to show you in the beginning, you're often not sure what's going on. But then afterwards, you're like, how could someone not see this? And Luis, this is what I want to prove to you. I want to prove to you that you're gonna be like, oh, I totally got this. This makes total sense. And if you make a card on this, and if you repeat this card using detailed pathophysiologic chronology every single time, when you see a question like this, and I guarantee you're gonna see a question like this in your test, it may not be this exact same scenario, but it'll be very similar. You'll know it. You'll know it. Because our goal is to make sure that you know automatically what every sentence is trying to tell you automatically in your test. This is the summary. Basically, she's, you know, our previous guy, smoking and pancreatic cancer, was 2 out of 3 of your guys, right? This lady's got 3 out of 3, smoking, endothelial damage, and she's got hypercoagulability, and, right, because of the OCPs, and she's got venous stasis. She's got a whomping DVT, which becomes a large PE, and that leads to right-sided heart failure. And the fact that it's right-sided heart failure is critical, because that's why she doesn't have crackles in her lungs, and that's leading to hypotension, and ultimately, again, cerebral hyperperfusion. Cool. Let's talk about heart failure. Pooja, what does heart failure mean? It's kind of this vague term.
Well, the heart's not able to pump blood adequately or...
Adequately for what? Adequate for what?
For the body's needs.
I know. It's the one time that the medical student answer is correct. Something really vague, but yeah, it's true. So basically, it's if you can't meet the body's blood demand, right? Or, you need excessive volume or pressure to do it adequately. The classic heart failure patient is they've got JVD up to their earlobe and they've got inspiratory crackles and all this stuff. That they may have adequate flow to their body, but they need so much volume to do it adequately. That's still considered heart failure. Let's talk about, oh, Pooja, you had a question?
Yes, I did. About the previous vignette, when we were talking about the Virchow's triad, when we're doing this on our own, should I think about what specifically in the blood is causing the hypercoagulability and is allowing?
What do you think?
I don't know.
If it was a time setting, what do you think?
Oh, no.
No, I probably wouldn't do it. Yeah. But if it was not outside of a test, maybe not every time, but I would say, yeah, you should think about what exactly is the mechanism which OCPs cause hypercoagulability? Sometimes I don't know. I don't really understand why cancer, I guess they say that there's mucin or something and it causes a tissue factor, I don't know, substitute or blah, blah, blah. But yeah. Yeah. But in theory, yeah, you should try to walk through exactly why at least once. Yeah. Because the more that you walk through it, the more automatic you're going to make it on your test. That's the goal. As long as you remember that, I think it will guide, it will make it a lot easier for you to think, oh, should I do this or not? Luis, do you have a question?
Yes, I was going to ask something related to the clinical vignette that I was reading. Usually the DVTs will be the cause for pulmonary. The DVTs, they will go into the pulmonary artery causing a PE. But then I got a little confused because when I saw the distension of the jugular veins, I didn't think of...
Let's talk about this. Let me ask you a question. So what are the signs of right heart failure? It's like I planted you there to ask that question. What are the signs of right heart failure?
Increased jugular distension because of the overload in the superior vena cava and there from there up. Yeah, basically a jugular vein distension. What else?
This is good. I'm glad that, yeah. Basically, almost everything that you think of as signs of heart failure are basically signs of right heart failure. Ascites, hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, jugular venous distension, lower extremity edema. All of those things are essentially right heart failures. I would actually, that should be something that you should know. You should absolutely know. That is a key concept that I want you to make automatic. Pooja, or I think we already did Pooja, Duralis. What's the mechanism of getting lower extremity edema in right heart failure?
Because for whatever reason, your heart is not able to either push that fluid forward, it's causing a backflow of the fluid. There's an increase in pressure due to the backflow.
Yeah, it depends on the cause. In this case, there's an increase in afterload for the right heart. But that's not always going to be true.
But you can, when you say increase in afterload, it could be calling it the right heart. You would just have to say it as opposed to
Yes, exactly. You have to specify afterload for the right heart.
Anyways, there's a back or an accumulation of fluid that is causing your heart to fail in the sense of not letting it push forward. That's going to cause that to move from the ventricle, all that fluid from the ventricle up to the atrium and then go into your venous system. That tends to cause the JVD, the jugular venous distension.
Lower extremity edema. We're focusing on one symptom or one sign.
In the end of the day, all that backflow is just going to cause an increase in your venous system to the point that your capillaries have a high hydrostatic pressure and cause it filtration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You get venous congestion, particularly in the dependent areas. You have capillary. It's in the capillaries, not really the venous system. Your capillaries are the thinnest part. So that's where if there's going to be fluid leak, it's going to be across the capillaries. There's more fluid leakage in the interstitium. That's what gives you pitting edema. Great. Hadra, on a test, or just in general, how do you differentiate between left and right heart failure? Because they always say, the most common cause of right heart failure is left heart failure. How do you differentiate between that, combined left and right heart failure, versus just having isolated right heart failure?
In isolated right-hand heart failure, patient will present with edema, hepatomegaly, ascites, JVP raised, but clear lungs. Mm. The lungs will be actually clear. But in left heart failure, because of the backup of blood, the lungs will not be, and yes, we'll have pulmonary edema and pulmonary capillary wedge pressure will be raised.
Boom. Pulmonary. Yeah, exactly. Usually what they'll say is they'll have inspiratory crackles. If they have a pulmonary artery catheter, which is pretty rare, but if they did, right? But both actual in real life, very few people get pulmonary artery catheters, but also in vignettes, they don't really have wedge pressure or pulmonary artery catheters that often. Almost always it's going to be the lung. I can't tell you how many times I'll see a question, it's about heart failure, and you'll say, you'll see pitting edema or something. And they have no idea why they're like, clear lungs. It's because there's no pneumonia. Something that's completely unrelated. Oh, no. Anytime that they give you signs of heart failure, you want to listen to the lungs, both in real life and in your vignette, especially in the vignettes, because they can't just, they're not going to come out and just tell you, it's just right heart failure. They have to give you a sign that it's just right heart failure. To give you a sign. And really, they're really restricted in the signs they can give you, because almost every sign of heart failure is really right-sided heart failure. If there's signs of right-sided heart failure without pulmonary edema, you should think isolated heart failure. Sometimes, literally, that is the only clue that they're going to give you, and that's how you're supposed to answer the question. Now, I want to go back to Luis. Luis, it's always hard to be put on the spot. It's always hard to do these questions. But I want you to tell me, now that we've reviewed these key concepts, right? Now I want you to tell me, what's the pathophysiologic chronology here?
Let's see. 36-year-old woman is born healthy. She starts smoking and using oral contraceptives. She takes a very long flight from South Korea to LA, where she develops DVTs in her lower extremities. Those DVTs will go to the pulmonary artery as a pulmonary embolism that will decrease the preload causing a decrease in the stroke volume, causing a decrease in the cardiac output, causing a decrease in MAP, and causing decreased cerebral hypoperfusion.
That's awesome. It's really interesting. I heard you say PE causing, there's a lot of hesitation, decrease in preload. But then, did you guys hear? It was like decrease in stroke volume, decrease in cardiac output, decrease in MAP, super hypoperfusion. It was just like, that part was automatic. Did you feel that, Luis?
Yeah, basically what I was being practicing from the session from Tuesday about just making sense of something and then just try to be automatic. Once you get to the point where you understand the clinical vignette, and then just from there on, just try to connect what variable affects the other variables from the, that's why I, yeah, just like you said, I hesitated a little bit, but from that PE for all the way to the decrease in the preload, the rest was basically automatic. A decrease in the stroke volume, decrease in the cardiac output, and then decrease in MAP, and then decrease cerebral brain.
But I think one of the things that you said that struck me was you said you've been drilling it since Tuesday, and now it's just become automatic. My thought when I hear that is that the same thing is going to be true for this vignette. Yeah, the first time that you saw this, it was pretty slow. The second time you saw this, part of it was slow, but other parts of it were faster. I guarantee that if you were to continue to just repeat this vignette, right, in your cards, and just the repetition, the practice, and make the connections every single time, that the next time you see this or a similar vignette, because there'll be similar vignettes, it will just be much faster, just the end of this vignette was. What are your thoughts, Louise?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I think that if you just the rest of the Anki cards, if you see the same card over and over, it doesn't matter if you don't study the card for a month or a month and a half, whenever the card appears, then the basic or the idea of the card just comes up automatically because you've been seeing it for quite a few months now. It doesn't matter if you go a couple of weeks without seeing that same concept, either the back or the front part of the card, you automatically can recall the clinical vignette related to the card you were seeing. Yeah, I think that repetition is the most effective way of just remembering stuff, because if you read it one time, if they change the clinical vignette and you haven't practiced the key concepts of that card over and over, you might hesitate a little bit. I just did. I knew that it had to do something with the DVTs and the PE, but then I hesitated which was the parameter that was affected, in this case, the preload. But I hesitated because I wasn't sure at the beginning, but then the rest of it just came out automatically. And I think it's thanks to the session we had 3 days ago.
Yeah, but it's because the other thing is, yeah, like you can see as you're doing the pathophysiologic chronology of the question, you can see where the rough spots are. It's just telling you, yeah, maybe that's the area that we want to focus on. That's the area, because you guys were asking, what are you supposed to focus on? Focus on the parts that are slowest. I know it's more pleasurable to do the ones that are faster, but I think Pooja was mentioning before, it's really pleasurable. It's hard, but you get this sense of satisfaction when you can see a vignette and you know exactly what every single sentence means. It just feels good. It just feels awesome. And I can tell you, it feels doubly awesome when that question is on your test, your actual exam. You're like, oh yeah, I know what every single, literally, I know what every single sentence means. I know why they're trying to tell it, why they're including it, you know, why there's a pertinent negative. You just get it. You feel like such a boss. Yeah. But it comes from, you want to continue to make these automatic.
I have a question. She had a PE, and because of that, it's causing the lightheadedness. But I'm assuming, I guess, PEs can have different severities, because I guess this wasn't that severe. She's having no hyperventilation or like...
Just because they don't say something doesn't mean it's not there. That's a...
But is that something like... It
she
might not
happen. Hyperventilate. Oh yeah. If they told you her respiratory rate, it would be high.
Okay. So it's like a for sure thing. Like she actually is having a trouble breathing and all that. It's just not like, oh, I feel kind of lightheaded. I might have a DVT. It's not anything like that.
In other words, the lack of a symptom doesn't necessarily mean that it's not there. This is one of my pet peeves about rule in and rule out. This is that oftentimes you guys will say, oh, this is ruled out because if it was this, then I would expect all of these symptoms. It's not necessarily true. First of all, clinically, that's not necessarily true. Diseases don't present in the classic way every time. There is such a thing as sensitivity and specificity of clinical signs and symptoms. And that doesn't even work in real life. But it certainly doesn't work in tests either. In this case, oh, the fact that she's not hyperventilating means that it can't be a large PE. They didn't tell you that her respiratory rate was normal. You don't have a pertinent negative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Yeah, that's good to know that it can't just rule it out because it's not there. But I guess for future knowledge, PEs generally, like, it's not because, like, oh, she had a small...
Large PEs are the ones that are hemodynamically significant.
Okay, little ones probably wouldn't even cause lightheadedness.
Small PEs would not cause lightheadedness unless you were very fragile.
Like, or you had some prior lung disease or something?
Yeah, if you had right heart problems to begin with, yeah, a small PE might be the one. But yeah, just think about it. A small PE is likely only to remove a very small resistor in your pulmonary arterial system. Removing a small resistor is not going to change your pulmonary resistance that much. A large PE is going to remove a large resistor from your pulmonary circulation. If you knocked out the right pulmonary artery, that's a huge resistor. That's going to cause a dramatic change in your pulmonary arterial resistance. That would be enough of a drop in preload to cause hypertension. But notice, I have made that concept automatic. This is a meta view, but you see how quickly that came to mind? It's because every single time I see these changes, either of increase in resistors or decrease in resistors, if I see a patent ductus arteriosus, if I see an AV fistula or something like that, I'm thinking about it in terms of resistors and parallel in series. I can see it. That's a side note. But yes, to your point, large PEs are the ones that will cause hemodynamic changes. Small PEs generally are just going to give you chest pain and hypoxemia. Thank you, guys. This was great. I want you to come up with your own automatic key concepts, or you can even just you can take the ones that we have here or in the previous presentation, but I want you to post them as a comment on this video. Knowing the right answer automatically, I want you to post them here so that we can all see how each other's doing and also to give feedback. Awesome.